in the limelight. Like all U.S. Secretaries of State, Antony Blinken's public statements overwhelmingly focus on the claim that other nations abuse human rights, and that it is America's duty to defend those rights. Which is very silly, considering the fact that the U.S. government is the single worst human rights abuser on planet Earth. We're prepared for you an article written by Caitlin Johnson, an independent journalist based in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled, World's Most Tyrannical Regime Can't Stop Babbling About Human Rights. A recent tweet from the U.S. presidential Twitter account reads, America won't back away from its commitment to human rights and fundamental freedoms, claiming, no responsible American president can remain silent when basic human rights are violated. The tweet, an excerpt from the U.S. president's prepared congressional address, was retweeted on Saturday, 1st of May, by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, with the caption, we will always defend human rights at home and abroad. Like all U.S. Secretaries of State, Antony Blinken's public statements overwhelmingly focus on the claim that other nations abuse human rights, and that it is America's duty to defend those rights. Which is very silly, considering the fact that the U.S. government is the single worst human rights abuser on planet Earth. And it's not even close. There is no other government that is circling the planet with hundreds of military bases and working to destroy any nation which disobeys it via invasion, proxy wars, blockades, economic warfare, staged coup d'etats and covert operations. There is no other government on earth whose violence has killed millions of innocent people and displaced tens of millions of people just since the turn of the century. There is no other government waging non-stop wars around the world and dropping scores of bombs per day on human beings in foreign nations in order to perpetuate its iron-fisted domination of our planet. And it just says so much about who is controlling the dominant narratives in our society that these actions are not considered human rights violations. Clearly, we should all have a human right not to be murdered by explosives dropped from the sky. And we in nations where this does not commonly occur would be very upset if it suddenly began happening to us. Clearly, it is an abuse of human rights to deliberately starve children to death because you don't approve of the people who run things in their part of the world. Clearly, it is abuse of human rights to turn a nation to rubble and chaos for profit and geostrategic control. Not a day goes by when the US government is not doing these things, both directly and indirectly, and through its imperial member states. Yet the US Secretary of State spends all day tweeting that other governments around the world are guilty of human rights violations, because as far as power is concerned, narrative control is everything. If mass murder is not an abuse of human rights, then human rights is a meaningless concept. But even if bombing campaigns and other acts of military butchery do not transgress your personal definition of human rights, the United States of America still does not care about human rights. As journalist Mark Ames recently flagged, a few years ago, the imperialist narrative managers were very keen on informing Americans that Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was a human rights abuser, but they haven't been hearing much about what an evil brute he is of late. So what happened? Did Rodrigo Duterte cease promoting the extrajudicial killing of drug users and spontaneously transform into a cuddly human rights advocate? Of course not. What happened? As journalist Mark Ames points out, is that Duterte ceased publicly toying with the notion of pivoting from Washington to Beijing, as he had been doing since taking office, shifting to a hard line against China in support of Manila's longtime imperial overlord. We saw the change in coverage because Washington and its imperial spinmeisters only care about human rights abusers insofar as they can be exploited against the few remaining nations like China that have insisted on their own sovereignty instead of allowing themselves to be converted into member states of the U.S. centralized empire. We know this not only from naked eye observations of the empire's behavior from year to year, but also because they have blatantly said so. As I never tire of reminding readers, a leaked 2017 State Department memo spelled out in plain English how the United States only cares about human rights when they can be weaponized against its enemies, and has a standing policy of ignoring human rights when they are committed by its allies or vassal states. In December of 2017, the website Politico published an internal memo that had been sent the previous May to the then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson by virulent neoconservative Brian Hook. The memo provided an insight into what it looks like when a toxic swamp monster orients a political neophyte to the inner mechanics of the empire, explaining the way human rights are really just a tool to be cynically leveraged to advance the goal of planetary hegemony. It reads like an old veteran explaining the backstory of to the new guy in the pilot episode of a new television series. Brian Hook explained in the memo, "In the case of U.S. allies such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Philippines, the administration is fully justified in emphasizing good relations for a variety of important reasons, including counterterrorism, and in honestly facing up to the difficult trade-offs with regards to human rights." Brian Hook further wrote, "One useful guideline for a realistic and successful foreign policy is that allies should be treated differently and better than adversaries. We do not look to bolster America's adversaries overseas. We look to pressure, compete with, and outmaneuver them. For this reason, we should consider human rights as an important issue with regards to U.S. relations with China, U.S. relations with Russia and North Korea. And this is not only because of moral concern for practices inside those countries, it is also because pressing those regimes on human rights is one way to impose costs, apply counter-pressure, and regain the initiative from them strategically." In imperialist terms, human rights is nothing other than a propaganda weapon to be used for building antagonistic international coalitions, manufacturing consent for invasions and regime change operations, and spinning the dominant narrative in support of starvation sanctions and world-threatening Cold War escalations. It's just mass-scale concern trolling of the most destructive and malignant sort imaginable. This is what you are feeding into, by the way, when you parrot State Department lines about how horrible and tyrannical U.S.-targeted governments are. You are helping to circulate the narratives our rulers are spending billions of dollars circulating, and you are doing it for free. You are making the jobs of the imperialists that much easier, because you are unwittingly operating as a pro bono Pentagon propagandist. Don't be a Pentagon propagandist, pro bono or otherwise. Don't be an imperial concern troll. Don't let the worst human rights abuser on earth get away with pretending to support human rights.
Around the World with Reporters. Scotland is at a crossroads yet again. A historic election that'll set the course of economic recovery and possibly open up a path towards independence from the UK. But this election, too, divisions among the voters persist.
I guess what we're looking for is a little bit of autonomy from Westminster, says the English person. We're looking for better healthcare.
Positive change for everyone.
Big one for me is about the referendum. I don't want to go down that route again.
First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, whose Scottish Nationalist Party looks set to win, says her priority, first and foremost, will be the economy, but that if voters give her the mandate for another referendum, she won't hesitate.
I think it will unleash a permanent crisis. I mean, the growth of the SNP, the appetite for independence, although we didn't secure a majority during in India F1, it doesn't show any sign of diminishing to any great extent. The numbers go up and down by 1 or 2 degrees. It's something which is almost permanent.
Parties hoping to scupper that plan, the Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democratic, who wish to stay in the UK. The SNP have been in power for more than a decade now, and they haven't exactly received praise for their performance in health and education, for example. But Nicola Sturgeon's response to the pandemic, her handling of the health crisis, has made her a popular leader, leaving many voters to forgive the SNP for their less successful performance in those other areas. If the SNP doesn't achieve a majority, Sturgeon could need to enter a coalition with other pro-independence parties for another referendum to become possible. Her next hurdle would be approval from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who hasn't minced his words.
This is not the time to have a reckless and I think irresponsible second referendum. We had one only a few years ago.
The first independence referendum was held in 2014. Europhile Scots voted to remain part of the UK so they could stay in the European Union. But then came Brexit and changed that calculus. Now they're seeking re-accession, and the only way to re-enter the bloc is to exit the United Kingdom. Saeed Puriza, Edinburgh.
The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces Committee in the Gaza Strip held a protest to support Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem al-Quds, where dozens of Palestinians are illegally displaced from their homes by force. In a press conference held during the protest, Palestinian leaders called on the international community to end this eviction that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause.
The apartheid policies and the displacement of Palestinians from their land is totally rejected by Palestinians. We stress that we won't allow the Nakba and the land grabbing that happened in 1978 to be repeated again. We are calling on the international community to stop these violations. We also call on all Palestinians to get united in order to end all Israeli conspiracies against Palestine.
Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip expressed solidarity with people in Sheikh Jarrah and held the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of this move. In a recent statement by Hamas military wing, its leader Mohammed Daif warned that Israel will pay a heavy price if attacks against Sheikh Jarrah continue.
The message of the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli regime for these violations against our people is clear. Jerusalem al-Quds is our red line, and the resistance won't allow such crimes to go unpunished. The Israeli occupation will pay the price if the eviction in Jerusalem al-Quds continues.
As observers say, Palestinians are forcibly displaced from Sheikh Jarrah to make way for Jewish settlers. The Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah have been stepping up their campaign to save their families from eviction in recent weeks.
We are supporting our people in Jerusalem al-Quds. The current displacement of Palestinians is totally illegal, as those are the real owners of this land. This move aims to demolish the Palestinian cause and expand the Jewish settlements. Israeli occupation should be held accountable for these crimes.
Similar rallies have been held by Palestinians against the eviction across occupied lands.
People here stress they are all united in defending Palestinian rights, and they won't remain silent over the illegal displacement of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Palestinian cause between interaction and disappointment is the slogan of this symposium held in the Great Mosque of Yemen's capital Sana'a to raise awareness on the importance of the Palestinian cause among Yemenis. A number of state officials participated in the symposium.
The International Quds Day is an important occasion to remind the Islamic nations of the Palestinian cause. We call on the Islamic world to take steps to liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation amid the continued acceleration of some Arab regimes to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
The participants affirmed that the Palestinian cause will remain the central issue of the Islamic nations despite the betrayal of some Arab regimes. They said Muslims should get united to help Palestinians to liberate their territories from Israeli occupation, especially the holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
For the Yemenis, the Palestinian cause is not restricted to the Palestinians alone. As Imam Khomeini said, we should prepare ourselves for the military step to eradicate the cancerous gland of Israel from the region.
The International Quds Day was initiated by late founder of the Islamic Republic to express support for the Palestinians and oppose Zionism and Israel.
Yemenis believe that the Palestinian cause is a global issue that requires all the free people of the world to stand by the Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from the Great Mosque of Sana'a.
International Quds Day is an event to express solidarity with Palestinians and oppose the Zionist regime. The day is observed by demonstrations around the world on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan. Muslims and non-Muslims communities hold rallies each year in different cities across the world to mark the occasion. Last year, Quds Day was held in Tehran and major cities like Mashhad by a procession of cars. People could attend Quds Day rallies by riding in their cars, but this year, as the situation is more critical, no rallies in person or in cars will be held. Here is a model of the Quds iconic mosque built in the holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza in Mashhad. The dome is built to show solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians.
After the last day of month of Ramadan was named Quds International Day, we built this structure here in the holy shrine to show support for the Palestinians. This structure is 8 times smaller than the Dome of the Rock in the occupied territories. Many of our programs to support the Palestinian cause are held over here.
We also talk to some people who are called Khadim or servant. They give service to pilgrims without getting any salaries. These people have a vow with their imam to serve the pilgrims.
I've been working here for more than 32 years in this court of the shrine. I do remember that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, this structure was built here, and since then, people hold cultural activities to show their anger at Israel.
Before the spread of the coronavirus, cultural events like exhibitions, art shows, seminars, conferences, and roundtables were held in this area, which is called Quds Court, to show solidarity with Palestinians. However, this year, to comply with the health protocols, just some restricted programs will be staged in the Quds Court of the Holy Shrine. Quds International Day is an annual event held on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, to express support for the Palestinians and show anger at Zionism and Israel. Uman Abedi, Mashhad.
The coronavirus pandemic has spread throughout the world, killing over 3 million and infecting over 150 million people worldwide from all different backgrounds. While the virus does not discriminate, people in the Western world do.
I was walking in the park and people might shout at me like coronavirus or something. So, but like, I would say Like, it's a bit unfair to blame everything on Asians.
The conceptions around coronavirus wasn't clear why it happened, so people just wanted to blame some people, and I think that's kind of unfair to, like, Asians.
In major cities in the US, anti-Asian hate crime has increased by 146%, and in the UK, there's been a staggering rise of 300% in hate crime against Chinese, East and Southeast Asians.
Flagrant racism of the Trump regime, Trump and Pompeo talking about the China virus and the Wuhan virus and the Kung flu and so on. All of these tropes, racial tropes, related to the coronavirus that were basically about the US administration trying to cover up its own complete uselessness when it came to containing the pandemic.
But when you look at the coverage in the mainstream media outlets in both the UK and the US, it becomes clear that the demonization of China goes much further than the Trump administration.
Very obviously linked to the escalating Cold War against China. If you look back two decades, the war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, that happened at the same time as this massive rise in Islamophobia, in anti-Muslim racism, which really peaked in the early and mid-2000s, just at the time when we were destroying Muslim countries in the Middle East and Central Asia. So, of course, there's no coincidence. You know, racism is never a coincidence.
As long as Beijing continues to grow and threaten the West's economic dominance, it's likely that the UK and the US's hostility towards China will continue, which could be bad news for East Asian communities living in both countries. Ahmed Kabela, London.
It is estimated that prior to the pandemic, 27 million people worked in the EU's hospitality sector. Small to medium-sized firms are described as the backbone of the 27-nation bloc's finances. The Eurozone economy has contracted further and is now in a so-called double-dip recession. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts.
It's impossible to stop everything. You know, the corona is there, the economy is dead.
Like waitresses or waiters, and they lost their job, so they are in a bad condition now.
Me too. Like I work, and my work is impacted of the coronavirus.
It's very difficult to have hope because we don't know what is going on, and we don't know what the future is made.
More and more workers lost their jobs, like restaurants.
Members of the European Parliament say the EU's aviation and tourism industries need emergency assistance.
Businesses in the hospitality sector are on their knees. They need not just financial support, but also longer-term measures to restart and recover. The tourism may never be the same.
Lawmakers say the EU's vaccination rollout is too slow. Just 10% of the population have been fully vaccinated. They are also highly critical over a lack of joined-up thinking when it comes to implementing COVID-19 restrictions. Governments were supposed to submit applications to the European Commission for recovery funding by last Friday. So far, just 14 of the 27 have done so. There is concern that the process lacks transparency.
We have encouraged all member states to make the submitted plans to the Commission public. But again, it's up to the member states to decide what they wish to publish.
An unprecedented social crisis might be on the horizon for the EU. It's possible the millions of jobs that have been lost so far only represent the tip of the iceberg. Several studies have concluded that up to one quarter of small to medium-sized businesses in the EU will go under once restrictions are lifted and government supports are taken away. These are firms that employ 250 people or less. Clearly, then, we're talking about huge numbers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey prioritizes Libya's integrity, sovereignty and independence. This is what Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu told his counterpart Najla Almankoş in a statement made after his visit, along with Defense Minister Hulusi Akar, Intelligence Chief Hakan Fidan and the Chief of Staff Yaşar Güler to Tripoli. During the meeting, Almankoş urged Turkey to help implement a UN Security Council resolution demanding the retrieval of foreign fighters from Libya. Cavusoglu responded to the remarks by saying that Turkish troops and mercenaries sent by Ankara were deployed in Libya as part of an agreement made with the previous administration and were only present for the purpose of training.
In the face of the attacks on Tripoli over the past years, the legitimate government of Libya invited some countries, including us. Only Turkey replied in the affirmative to this call. Turkey's support for Libya prevented a civil war and human tragedy.
This visit is seen by many as very important for Turkey to maintain good ties with the new Libyan government and make sure agreements are not broken due to political changes in Tripoli. However, it seems that the new government does not welcome foreign troops anymore.
Turkey signed an agreement with the central government in Tripoli, which is recognized by the UN. Based on that agreement, Turkey sent troops and mercenaries to Libya. Unless that agreement is broken by any or both sides, Turkish troops will continue to be present there. Turkish forces are not alone there. There are also Syrian fighters, Chadian army, as well as Russian. Their presence must also be questioned.
Turkey also signed an agreement with the previous Libyan government on maritime boundaries in the Mediterranean, which created tensions between Turkey and Greece. Ankara sees a great importance in maintaining good relationship with the Tripoli amid mounting tensions in eastern Mediterranean. Libya is still considered Turkey's strategic partner. For Turkey, the visit meant to make sure things are still going well after the new Libyan interim government was sworn in. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests, almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal, since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign minister's spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran, since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
With U.S. President Joe Biden still under fire for proposing a $753 billion national defense budget for the next fiscal year, the bulk of which would go to the Pentagon, a report published recently exposes the huge sums pay to the CEOs and other top executives of the nation's five largest weapons contractors in 2020. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett, writer. This article is published under the heading Execs at Top Pentagon Contractors Raked in $276.5 million Last Year, Analysis Finds. Stay tuned for more. With U.S. President Joe Biden still under fire for proposing a $753 billion national defense budget for the next fiscal year, the bulk of which would go to the Pentagon, a report published recently exposes the huge sums paid to the CEOs and other top executives of the nation's five largest weapons contractors in 2020. The new Center for International Policy CIP issue brief entitled Executive Excesses, CEO Compensation in the Arms Industry 2020. This was authored by William D. Hartung and Leila Riazi, who began by acknowledging the current president's recent proposal, which has been widely rejected by progressives. These enormous sums for the Pentagon are often justified as necessary to meet the needs of military personnel, Hartung and Riazi note, but in fact, roughly half of the Pentagon's budget is spent on corporations like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon Technologies, and Northrop Grumman, as well as the hundreds of thousands of private contractors employed by the department. The brief points out that those top five weapons firms received over $150 billion in Pentagon contracts during fiscal year 2020, and not all of these funds are well spent. Cost overruns and performance problems, expenditures on weapon systems that are not relevant to current security challenges, and investments in weapons that actually make the world a more dangerous place all detract from, rather than enhance, America's security, the report says. There is also widespread waste and excess overhead within the Pentagon, which is the only major federal agency that has never successfully passed an audit. Hartung and Riazi highlight executive compensation as one indicator of Pentagon waste, noting that in 2020 alone, the CEOs of those top five contractors collectively raked in $105.4 million. When other major executives at these firms are taken into account, those holding the top positions at each firm whose salaries are required to be publicly disclosed, total executive compensation at the major contractors comes out to $276.5 million for 2020, the report says. Total compensation for major executives of top five contractors exceeded $1 billion in total for the 4 years from 2017 to 2020. The brief contrasts the wealth of weapons contractor executives with the pay of U.S. service members, noting that average annual CEO compensation for the top five contractors is over $21 million per year, compared to roughly $39,000 in pay and basic benefits for a first-year military enlistee, a ratio of over 500 to 1. A general of the highest rank earns well over $200,000 per year, the report adds, still only about 1/100th of average CEO pay at the top five contractors. The report also highlights the substantial share of each company's revenue that comes from Pentagon contracts, emphasizing that it means portions of the salaries they pay their executives are subsidized by taxpayers. According to the brief, for four of the top five contractors, defense revenues accounted for three quarters or more of their business in 2019, the last year for which full figures are available for this measure, which includes sales to both the U.S. government and foreign government. When just sales to the U.S. government are taken into account, the figures range from roughly 37.5% for Boeing, which makes commercial aircraft, to 84% for Northrop Grumman, which figures available as of 2020. Hartung and Riozzi also detail how many jobs could be created if the $276.5 million in compensation for executives at those five contractors was indeed instead invested in education, green energy, healthcare, or infrastructure. Though it represents a small portion of overall U.S. military spending, such an investment could create 2,710 new jobs in infrastructure or green energy, 3,954 in healthcare, or 4,203 in education, the brief says. Exorbitant compensation for executives of the top Pentagon contractors subsidized by the taxpayer is just one of the examples of excessive overhead at these firms, said Hartung, director of CIP's Arms and Security Project, in an emailed statement. Congress and the administration should take a closer look at these costs with an eye toward reducing them and freeing up funds for other needed purposes. As Common Dreams reported after Biden unveiled his spending proposal last month, a diverse coalition of progressive advocacy groups has made a similar demand. It is crystal clear that the status quo is failing to keep communities at home and abroad safe, the coalition said, adding that there are numerous proposals on how to rein in the gargantuan Pentagon budget while increasing national and global security. We are eager to work with Congress and the Biden administration to support these or other long overdue efforts to scale back Pentagon spending, the coalition said. It added, the American people know that producing more weapons, green lighting corporate contracts, and propping up endless war slush funds will not make us safer.
Africa Today.
The people of Africa join the rest of the world every year to mark the International Coast Day to express solidarity with the Palestinian people. This year, Coast Day rallies are restricted in most parts of the world due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, despite the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions recently in South Africa, the ruling party's ANC Provincial Secretary Jacob Howe organized a protest gathering in the country's capital, Pretoria, against the Israeli apartheid regime. Let's take a listen.
Palestine, we love you! Palestine, we love you! Palestine, we love you! Palestine, we love you! Israel, you're a murderer! Israel, you're a murderer! Israel, you're...
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is a special edition on the occasion of the International Coast Day. We shall be talking about Africa's support for the liberation of Palestine and Coast Day in Africa.
Africa's support for Palestine. The International Quds Day is a legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. Quds is the Arabic name for Jerusalem. Imam Khomeini designated the day in solidarity with Palestinians who have been persecuted by the usurper Israeli regime for over seven decades. Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, the International Quds Day has been held worldwide on the last Friday of the Holy Muslim Fasting Month of Ramadan. Supporters of the Palestinian Liberation Movement from across the world, regardless of race and religion, now recognize the International Quds Day as the day of condemning the apartheid regime of Israel and expressing solidarity with Palestinians.
African people have always strongly and passionately supported the Palestinian people and their right to self-determination. Palestinians recall the historic proclamation of the iconic anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela, who said, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." Now, over the years, African people have always turned out massively to mark the International Quds Day. For an incisive analysis on Africa's support for Palestine, we contacted Tshepo Magama, an activist and a former member of South African Parliament. He's also a senior board member and spokesperson of Africa for Palestine. We also have Bukangesa, a member of Kenya Palestine Solidarity Movement. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time. Let's start off with Mr. Magama in South Africa. Now, African countries have over many decades supported Palestine. What's the state of this support currently?
Well, of course, African countries remain committed to the Palestinian question. But of course, what we have also seen, at least for the past decade or so, and this actually started even before the advent of Trump in the U.S., that the U.S. started exerting pressure on African leaders to take a step back on the Palestinian question. So that was nearly intensified by Trump, but of course there was much more a focus on the issue of African support for Palestine. And then of course you had a push from the side of the U.S. To get African countries to support Israel. And then on the agenda of the African Union, then came the question of Israel trying to get an observer member seat, which of course has hitherto been unsuccessful.
That's Tshepo Magama, an activist and a former member of South African Parliament.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, many African people in countries such as Nigeria, Ghana, Tanzania, Kenya, and South Africa held various protest marches or indoor gatherings to show of solidarity with Palestinians. These gatherings attracted both Muslims and non-Muslims in support of the liberation of Palestine.
But we must be very clear that the people of Palestine have every right to struggle for their dignity and their freedom. And we support that struggle.
Now I'd like to ask Mr. Angesa, how important is it for Africans to show solidarity with Palestinians, especially during the International Quds Day?
First of all, I would say that the Al-Quds International Day for the African people and same to the Palestinian people is a day to confront the arrogant powers, of the United States and the apartheid regime in Israel and also their Western allies. That's how the African people see the International Al-Quds Day.
Mr. Bukangesa, a member of Kenya Palestine Solidarity Movement.
Muslims in Nigeria hold some of the largest rallies marking the International Quds Day amid brutal crackdown by security forces in the country. Nigeria's top Muslim cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki, the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, has been in detention since late 2015. He played a major role in popularizing Quds Day in the country. Even during his incarceration, Muslims continued to heed his call and turn out in large numbers during Quds Day rallies.
Now, Mr. Ngesa, over the years, many African cities have witnessed rallies and events marking the International Quds Day. Now, is the anti-Zionist movement growing in Africa?
Now, from the interpretation of my long involvement of anti-Zionist Zionist movement in Africa and global, I can see that the popularity of the rallies to support the Palestinian struggle has been moving from strength to strength, because certain divisive campaigns that have been, bringing down the solidarity has since been defeated. In fact, in the last 7 years, the scaling up of anti-Zionist movement in Africa has been commendable, especially being driven by the political parties of the left and even the progressive human rights organization and global citizens of the world.
Following on from last year's successful campaign for Quds Day, and in spite of the continued challenges due to the COVID-19 pandemic, this year's Quds Day will once again be a global fly-the-flag campaign in many countries. During this campaign, freedom-seeking people from around the world raised the flag for Palestine on the days leading to the Quds Day.
Mr. Angesa, this year, just like last year, there will be few or no public rallies on Quds Day. Now, what online activities are being held there in Kenya to keep alive this movement for the support of Palestine?
In Kenya, as the founding member of Kenya-Palestinian Solidarity Committee and even Kenyans for Palestine here in Kenya, we will be escalating a few online and offline activities to highlight the Al-Quds Day. And the most important one is the BDS movement, and we have already rolled out the first newsletter to highlight why we should not be supporting a regime profiting from war. We should not, supporting the African people should disassociate themselves from the regime that is profiting from occupying and subjugating other people.
Now, Mr. Ngesa, they have talked about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, popularly known as the BDS. Now, this is a movement that works to end international support for Israeli regime's oppression of Palestinians. Mandla Mandela, the grandson of Nelson Mandela, elaborates here on the importance of the BDS movement.
Let me say it loud and clear, ladies and gentlemen, for all to hear. Next to the internal popular protest movement waged in the face of all odds by the brave and courageous children, women and men of occupied Palestine, BDS is the most painful thorn in the side of apartheid Israel.
Now, Mr. Magama, how successful is the movement to boycott the Israeli regime in Africa?
I think the work that is being done is commendable. There's still a lot more work that needs to be done. As I alluded to earlier, we need to build that broad constellation of forces. There's still a lot of potential, to spread BDS across the continent and, of course, other continents as well, Latin America, Asia itself, the larger Asia, and so on and so on. So I'm saying to you that instead of looking at its successes, I think perhaps one specific success that I want to highlight, having spoken about Quds Day a moment ago, is to say one of the things it has done, it is to sensitize people around the plight of the Palestinian people, such that you now have many more people aware of what is happening, and it has effectively, or is indeed effectively, countering Israeli and U.S. propaganda.
Dr. Ramzi Berood, Palestinian author, journalist, and academic, visited Kenya to launch his new book, The Last Earth, A Palestinian Story. Now, speaking to a local TV station there, he attempted to elaborate on the commonalities between Palestinian and the Kenyan struggle for independence. Now, let's take a listen.
Frankly, and maybe I'm being a little bit too bold with this statement, but I believe that if you do not support the Palestinian people, you are betraying the very legacy of your own anti-colonial struggle in this country. Mm-hmm. You have, there are certain parts of your history. If I take that text or that passage describing these parts of your history, and I take the certain terminology out and replace it with Palestinians, it would read as if you are reading Palestinian history. It's one and the same.
Now, Mr. Ngessa, what are some of the commonalities between Africa and Palestine in terms of struggle against colonialism and occupation?
Have a common history with history of colonialism. They also have a history of occupation. They have a history of subjugation. So in that way, then there is a lot of common aspects between the Palestinian struggle and the struggle of the African people. Remember that in Kenya, when we have the British colonialists here, the Kenyan masses had to come together and fight against the British colonization and also to free their prisoners. In that way, we see a lot of common, historical facts around the struggle for the Palestinian statehood and the struggle of the African people, or even the people, or the colonized people of the world.
Now, Mr. Magama, we have had Mr. Ngessa talking about the commonalities between African and Palestinian struggle against colonialism. Now, I understand you have visited the occupied territories and you had first-hand experience with Israeli brutality. Now, how will you compare the current Israeli apartheid regime and South Africa during the apartheid regime?
You see, there is a deliberate conflation of what we say when we say that Israeli apartheid shares some similarities South African apartheid. But by saying that, we are merely talking about the similarities. But it is in many respects much, much worse than it was under this brutal apartheid settler colonial regime that we faced in South Africa. So that should not be, mistaken or misconstrued. It is indeed the experience of many of us, of those who had the opportunity to visit the occupied Palestinian territories. And that is why the Israeli regime goes out of its way to prevent, people to visit the occupied Palestinian territories. I know I've had that experience myself when leading a committee of parliament, we were simply denied entry to Gaza.
After the 1993 Oslo Accord, Palestinian authorities, led by the PLO, decreased their active engagement with Africa. Instead, they endlessly turned towards the goodwill of the West, hoping that the very colonial powers that had primarily created, sustained, and armed Israel would miraculously become more balanced and humane.
Now, Mr. Magama, how did the Oslo agreements and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime impact on the support of African states for Palestine?
That the struggle is not over. There's still a lot more work that needs to be done, and that indeed we have to intensify, the struggle against this brutal, settler colonial regime, and bring a decisive end to the Palestinian question. But having said that, I think one of the negative consequences, to speak directly to your question, was that there was that sense that, okay, at least now we are seeing the end of the road. But I think everybody has now woken up to the realization that this has been a farce all along, and that Israel had no such intentions, in spite of the best attempts of Palestinians, to implement the stipulations of the Oslo Accord. Israel had no intentions of making good on its promises.
Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about how some African countries are being forced to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Don't go away.